So if you would, turn your Bibles to Ruth. We are in Ruth chapter 2 today. Not Ruth chapter 2. That was last week. I could preach it again for those who weren't here. How about Ruth chapter 3? Yeah, Ruth chapter 3. We're making our way through the book of Ruth. Next week we'll be in chapter 4 and we'll conclude the book. A verse that just kind of captured my attention in the with the focus of what Ruth and Naomi are going through was a verse that's been dear to me for many years out of Proverbs. Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and do not lean on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge Him, and He will make your paths straight. Goes on, though. Do not be wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord and turn away from evil. It will be healing to your body and refreshment to your bones. Is there any people that needed more refreshment in their spirit, in their body, and needed more comfort from the Lord than these two ladies, these two widows in their circumstances, seeking the Lord's grace and mercy, which is beginning to be demonstrated from chapter 2? But now they simply just trust in the Lord, and they don't walk according to their own understanding. They just acknowledge Him, and God will certainly set their paths straight. As a reminder for those who maybe weren't here, or just a refresher for all of us, chapter 1 of the book of Ruth, Naomi and her husband Elimelech and their two sons had moved out of Bethlehem and moved to Moab, one of the countries that wasn't the chosen land, because of a famine in their own land. Naomi's husband died while upon arrival. Then her sons married foreign women who worshiped foreign gods. And 10 years later, they both died. And Naomi is left with two daughters-in-law. One returns back to her family, and one presses her to say, I would like to return with you to Bethlehem. The application I considered for chapter 1 is that we can't run from God and go our own way. But when we come to the end of ourselves, there we will find God. In chapter 2, we see that upon returning to Bethlehem, you have these two ladies, Naomi and Ruth. Ruth has come to faith through the testimony and life of Naomi. We see that upon returning to Bethlehem, Ruth begins to gather grain, and it sustains them. By God's providence, she gleans or gathers the extra leftover grain from Boaz's field, who ends up falling in love with Ruth and protects and provides for her. The application to take away from chapter 2, and there are many, but one is that every one of us is invited to come and find blessing under the wings of God, for He certainly will extend His mercy and grace and blessings upon those who are searching righteously for Him. He loves us even though we may have run from Him. He desires for us to take refuge in His caring and compassionate arms. In chapter 1, there was redemption through the difficulties. In chapter 2, you see there's a redemption through divine blessings. Today, I want us to focus on the redemption through dependence. Dependence being that which brings humility from our lives. When we have no control of our circumstances, we must certainly just depend on the God above and humble ourselves and do what is right, even if we do not know what the results will be. It is interesting through observation, and this is just from the New American Standard text, that chapter 1, chapter 2, and chapter 4 starts with the word now. Chapter 3 starts with the word then. So that was interesting. I'm not sure why, but I say now, now, then, now. According to chapter 2, verse 23, leaving from chapter 2, Ruth had been gleaning from Boaz's field at his permission, and he continuing to give her an additional harvest. Continued to glean from Boaz's field, the barley and the wheat harvest. And there was a couple of months that takes place between chapter 2 and chapter 3 because she continues to do this through the entire season of her gleaning. And Boaz and Ruth become more fond of each other, I believe. Now, Boaz is a kinsman redeemer. I'm trying to set this up so you'll begin to see the text here in just a few moments. But Boaz is what's considered a kinsman redeemer. It's something that's already been spoken of by Naomi earlier in chapter 2. He's a goel, is the Hebrew word. He is someone who is not only a kinsman, but he is closest in line to be able to redeem or purchase the property of a fallen or a deceased relative. Let me explain kind of what this means in Old Testament time period. God had assigned each family of each tribe a section of the promised land to inhabit. So when they moved into the land, everybody had their own plot of ground. It was a beautiful concept. This is yours. It's yours for generations upon generations. The land is extremely important to the Israelites and to God. So, to make it make sure it stays with the family, if a man has to sell his land, or if he dies and the family is unable to keep the land, a next of kin may come along and redeem that land, marry the wife, the widow, and take that land with the widow, produce children to carry on the name of that family. It's beautiful is also in the year of Jubilee, the 50th year, when all the land and possessions of those who have lost it through debt was wiped clean and returned to everyone who it belonged to originally. It was like you got a do-over, a fresh life, like we seem to do at New Year's, saying, yes, the old has passed, now the new has come. God granted that to his people. Whether it actually took place or not, the other night I was discussing with somebody, it was established but unsure of whether it actually was fulfilled by the Israelite people, because especially during the time of the judges, there was much rebellion, and people did what was right in their own eyes and did not always fulfill the law of God. But if this man died and left his land, and the land was left, and the widow had bore no sons, this nearest of kin would be given the opportunity to buy the land, marry the widow, and have sons to carry on the deceased name. If he wouldn't do it, the nearest kin wouldn't do it, the next closest kin could redeem, and so on. But there was a catch. According to one commentator, there was a catch. I didn't read this in other commentary, so I'd have to, I'm not 100% sure of this. I always try to let you know when I'm not so sure, even though it preaches well. But the catch was, the kinsman redeemer couldn't pursue and make the decision to redeem on his own. He had to be asked by the widow to redeem her husband's land. He was at bay, held at bay, until the widow desired to request it. Interesting. It takes a humility of a person to trust in the Lord and to depend on someone else for what you're unable to do for yourself. Andrew Murray, a pastor of another generation and a writer, says this: humility is simply the disposition which prepares the soul for living by trust. He says another part of the book on humility: humility, the place of entire dependence on God, is, from the very nature of things, the first duty and the highest virtue of the creature, and the root of every virtue. Basically, humility upon God is one of the foundational virtues of someone who truly loves God. Humility. In contrast, he writes this: therefore, pride, or the lack of humility, is the root of every sin and evil. So we either live by humility or we live by pride. One produces sin and evil, the other produces the very nature of God within, the virtuous personality and characteristics. So today, as we kind of comb through this passage, I want us to see three positions of humility. And the first one is this, in the first five verses: And Ruth really taking the position of humility here. Humility welcomes the right counsel. Looking at this from an applicational standpoint, but realizing there's far more theology that's happening here, and we're going to deal with most of that in the next chapter about God's ultimate redemption, kinsman redeemer, redeeming us from where we are. But today I want you to consider Ruth and her humility, welcoming the right counsel. Naomi had hoped that Boaz would take the initiative and establishing a good relationship with Ruth, therefore opening up the opportunity for Naomi and or Ruth to ask for the redemption. She, Ruth being an alien scavenger, Boaz being the native landowner, Naomi's hope was that this marriage and redemption would occur. And perhaps Boaz was being sensitive towards Ruth as a widow, not wishing to impose upon her until she was emotionally healed and ready to contemplate remarriage. Naomi takes it upon herself to initiate this kinsman redeemer opportunity. That's what we'll see in the first five verses. Naomi's no longer thinking of just herself and her own difficult experiences. She has witnessed the hand of God in action, especially in chapter 2, providing and protecting for the two of them on this temporary basis. But what you'll see here in verse 1 and 2 is that she's concerned more for her daughter-in-law, Ruth, not just for the temporary, but for a long term. How will she be taken care of? If Naomi were to die, what would happen to Ruth? And Ruth needs help. And Naomi gives counsel. And Ruth receives this counsel. To begin this process of redemption, Naomi describes, I'll just show you three things, a problem, a possibility, and a prescription. She describes the problem in verse 1. Look at it with me. Then Naomi said to her daughter, "My daughter, shall I not seek security for you, that it may be well with you?" It's the first of two rhetorical questions. May I not seek security? I would like things to be well with you for a period of time, a longer period of time than just the now. There's the problem. There is no long-term security for you. The second thing, she describes the possibilities and lists two facts. Verse 2, now, fact number 1, now, is not Boaz our, interesting plural, our kinsman with whose maids you were? You've been hanging out for this whole season of harvest with the maids of Boaz, and is not Boaz our kinsman? Yes. He could marry me. He could also marry you. And our family line would continue. The fact number 2, she says, and behold, he winnows barley at the threshing floor tonight. The possibility is, yes, he is a running mate. He is one of the bachelors that is definitely somebody we should consider. And guess what? Tonight, he's available. You need to go see him. That's what she's about to tell him. So there's a problem, but there's some possibilities here. Barley was typically threshed on the outset of the dry season after all the grain, both barley and wheat, was cut and gathered. So we're at the end of the harvest season. Time is running out for the natural connection that Ruth would have to Boaz by gleaning from the field. The season is over. In the next few weeks, they wouldn't have just a normal connection. So Naomi sees this opportunity. We know who he is. It's been months you've been working there. We know who he is, and tonight he's going to be here. It's the end of the season. We have to take our opportunity. Now, this is very encouraging language to me as I read through the book of Ruth. Naomi hasn't had this excitement or this anticipation or this hope expressed verbally until this time. She saw in chapter 2 that God was bringing Boaz, just happened to be where Ruth went, right? But now she's thinking, look at the season. Know the times and the seasons. This is our opportunity. God has opened it up. You've been working with him. Tonight is going to be the end of the harvest. He's up on the field, or up on the hill. He's working up there with his barley and wheat. A hilltop location typically was required to take advantage of the wind that would blow away the chaff as they threshed the grain and tossed it up in the air, allowing separating the kernels of the grain to fall to the floor. Boaz chose to do his winnowing at night, presumably because of the night breezes that were more desirable than the gusty winds of the daytime. The end of the season, the final, perhaps the final opportunity. Naomi is basically saying, Boaz is in alignment with who we need, and he's available. Will we take our opportunities? Tonight. So there's a problem, possibility. So then she sets up this prescription. And I won't explain all of this yet until it's actually accomplished by Ruth, but I want you to listen through the four things that she says to Ruth. And to Ruth, it was such a foreign concept. She did not come from a culture that has a kinsman-redeemer relationship. It was all to their own in her culture. But this prescription, how does this work in the Hebrew culture? Then she has four actions that are designed to make Ruth as desirable to Boaz as possible. The first thing she tells her to do is to be attractive. Verse 3 says, wash yourself, therefore. Anoint yourself. Basically, apply some perfume. Put on your best clothes. This washing, this perfume, clothing, perfume and clothing change is very similar, though, to David. Remember when David had a child with Bathsheba? And that child got sick and was on the deathbed? And David was mourning and praying and very sad about this child. But once it was revealed that this child had passed, this child had died, he gets up. And it says, just like in this same passage with Ruth, he gets up. He washes himself. This is 2 Samuel 12, verse 20. David arose from the ground, washed, anointed himself, and changed his clothes. And they asked him, why did you do that? Well, when the child was sick, you were grieved, but now you're not in mourning. You're like going on with life. And David said, well, where he is, I will be too. That's a paraphrase. What can I do now? He can't bring him back to life, so therefore he goes on. I think what's happening here in Ruth, she's doing the very same thing David's going to do. Her very great grandchild in a few generations is doing. You got to realize that she has been in mourning for a season. A long season. It's possible. And I may be reading into the text here, but I want to understand the whole situation here. She lost her husband. She's probably showing an indication that she's in mourning by her own clothing. And she's been, you know, going out to the fields and gathering and bringing it back, but she is still grieving her husband. I think what Naomi is saying to her right here, she's not just saying, hey, go out and look at all of your dresses and pick out the prettiest one. Get your Easter dress on. She's not saying, just put on your best clothes here. She's saying, perhaps it's time to change clothes and stop grieving that which is lost. God has opened up a new opportunity for life for you. Wash yourself, put on your perfume, take off your mourning clothes, and put on your clothes prepared for a new day. God may be saying that to many of you as you have still been grieving something of the past. And Naomi, here, what she's saying to Ruth is what God's saying to you. It's time to get up. It's time to move on. It's time to capture, to be attractive for your future of possible opportunities. So she tells her to be attractive in verse 3. She goes on in verse 3 and she says, be attentive. Tells her, after you've done these things, go down to the threshing floor. And do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. He's worked hard all day. He's been eating and drinking. And then verse 4, it shall be when he lies down that you shall take notice of the place where he lies. I mean, pay attention. Be attentive. You're going to be attractive. You're going to be attentive. Know what's happening here. Certainly he'll be in a relaxed mood after eating and drinking and working, and he will drop off quickly to sleep. Then she tells him, tells her to be assertive. And then you're going to go in. He's probably all asleep at this time. You shall go and uncover his feet and lie down. Now that seems a little strange to me. Does that strike you odd? All right, you're going to go up. This man's been working hard. He's drunk his drink. He's eaten his food. Now he's asleep. And you're going to sneak into his tent and you're going to go to his feet and uncover his feet and you're going to lie down next to his feet. And I'll explain that in a little bit, but I just want to put that in your mind if you've not seen that. If I had someone do that to me, I don't know if it would turn out so well. But she's attractive, she's attentive, she's assertive, and then she's available. She tells her at the end there, and then he will tell you what you shall do. Take a position of humility and just do whatever he says. In verse 5, and said to her, all that you say, I will do. Now here's a foreign woman in a foreign land to herself. She's not familiar with these customs. She doesn't know what her future holds, but she's been very eager to embrace whatever God opens the doors for. Naomi has said, you can do this, go out and glean, and she does. She's looking for the blessings. It may be strange to her in all of these customs, but she's willing to do whatever because she's already made the bold commitment. Your God will be my God. Where you go, I'll go. Basically, whatever you say, I'm going to do and fulfill this. Trusting. There is a dependence here upon God shown through the humility she has to have with Naomi. Seeking that counsel in saying, very clearly, all that you say I will do. She doesn't understand it all, but she's willing to trust. Just a few thoughts on Ruth's tremendous humility, trust, and dependence in Naomi here. She's counting on her commitment to the Lord. Ruth is counting on Naomi's commitment to the Lord in His Word. This kinsman redeemer teaching is foreign to Ruth, but she'll trust Naomi and the Lord and the Word through this. She's counting on Naomi's protection of her. Certainly, Naomi's not putting her in harm's way. She's going to enter a guy's tent in the middle of the night. Seems a little risky, but I'll trust you, Naomi. She's counting on Naomi's judgment as to proper etiquette, avoiding the appearance of seduction. It was not uncommon in those days, especially in the days of the judges. At the end of the harvest season, the men would gather and they do their work. They would have their food and wine. They go off to their tent. And ladies of the evening would go into their tents and do very similar things here that it's saying that Ruth's going to do, but they would take it a step further, obviously. For Naomi to even suggest that a foreigner put on clothes and perfume and go into a man's tent was not going to be seen as a beautiful thing, perhaps taking a risk of her own reputation. She has to trust. Naomi says this is the right thing to do and doing it in the right way. She's not a lady of the evening, but she's going to do this in a worthy manner. She has to count on Naomi's assessment of Boaz's character as well, hoping that Boaz will receive this in the proper way. You see what happens when she walks in and he wakes up. What is to happen here? What if Boaz reacts wrongly? What if he gets angry? Or what if he takes the proposition in the wrong manner and throws her out? But in all of this, you see a humility in Ruth saying, okay, I'm dependent upon the Lord to guide my steps. I'm humble enough to receive counsel, and I will apply and do everything you've said. I want you to look at the second portion here in verses 6 through 15. A humility that works in the right way. It's one thing to hear wise counsel and walk away and say, well, I may be wiser still and do my own thing, but it's certainly true humility is taking the right counsel and working in the right way. Humility is not about humiliation. Humility is about truth. The truth inerrant in the statement, God is God and I am not, and I will trust Him regardless of what He tells me. C.S. Lewis said this about humility. True humility is not thinking less of yourself. It is thinking of yourself less. If I could, I would always work in silence and obscurity, C.S. Lewis writes, and let my efforts be known by their results. That's what Ruth's going to have to do. Just work in silence of the evening, do exactly what she's told, and then trust God for the results. So look at verse 6. So she went down to the threshing floor and did according to all that her mother-in-law had commanded her. When Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. And she came secretly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. Exactly what the mother-in-law told her. Verse 8 says, it happened in the middle of the night that the man was startled, literally shivered. Is what the Hebrew is. Startled or shivered. Well, why not? It's in the evening. The wind is blowing through. He's a little cold and his feet are cold. And bent forward. And behold, a woman was lying at his feet. That's a little startling in and of itself. In verse 9, he said, who are you? It's dark, see? But also, she doesn't have morning clothes on. She's got a completely different outfit. And she answered, I am Ruth, your maid. Basically, what she's preparing to do is a marriage proposal. Listen to the very next words. So spread your covering over your maid, for you are a close relative. You are a Goel. You are a kinsman redeemer. Spread your covering. The gesture of a man covering a woman with his garment was a symbolic act of establishing a new relationship, a new covenant. And here she is making the proposal. I am Ruth, your maid. Will you spread your covenant covering over me? For you are my kinsman redeemer. God has chosen you, and now I am choosing you. In the middle of the night, perhaps midnight or after, startled Boaz wakes up to find Ruth sitting at his feet and then asks him to perform his duties as her family redeemer. Have you ever been in one of those situations where something big just happened to you but you weren't quite prepared? Perhaps you had thought about it, perhaps you hadn't thought about it. But you're going to have to make a decision right now. You can't just say, I'm going to put this off. Let me think about it for a while. Sometimes God opens the doors for us of opportunity, and He doesn't want us to delay. He wants us to make a decision. Now, He rightly makes the decision, and you're going to see what He's doing. There is a little delay here, but because of certain perspective, I think Boaz had already thought about these conditions. You're going to see that He does four things. Boaz makes some praises, he makes a promise, he reveals something, and then he reassures her. Verse 10, then he said, may you be blessed of the Lord, my daughter. Well, that's a good sign, first off. He is speaking praise to her at the revelation that she's sitting or lying down at his feet. He does not act unbecomingly. He doesn't proposition her or push her out of the tent. May you be blessed of the Lord, my daughter. You have shown your last kindness to be better than the first by not going after young men, whether poor or rich. He praises her for what she's done. And then in verse 11, he promises her, now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you whatever you ask. That's a good promise. For all my people in the city know that you are a woman of excellence. You know, it was on the bulletin cover today. I thought, we don't plan these things. They just kind of come out like they do. But beauty without virtue is like a rose without scent. Virtue and excellence are synonymous words in the scriptures. In Proverbs chapter 31, you've perhaps heard of the virtuous woman or the woman of excellence. This is Solomon writing. The great, great grandchild of Ruth. He writes this phrase, you know, who can find an excellent woman? And his great-great-grandmother and grandfather says of his great-great-grandmother, you are an excellent, virtuous woman. The beauty that she obviously had on the outside was even more beautiful on the inside, and Boaz knew it. I think it's a beautiful passage to connect, certainly, speaking to one of our members several weeks ago about the positioning of the Hebrew books are not always put in chronological order, and perhaps the Ruth here was Job, Proverbs, Ruth. Fitting right in that Ruth is illustrating who the virtuous woman is from Proverbs. Isn't that beautiful? Not chronologically, but thematically, you certainly see that. That she is the virtuous woman. Now think about this excellent virtuous woman. She's from Moab, not a Hebrew. But God has done something tremendous within her, and the beauty of that as Christ's fulfillment is going to be displayed here through her life. So there's this praise, there's this promise, there's this revelation. This is the turning point. All right, she's wonderful and she is a virtuous, excellent woman. But Boaz, can you make the decision? Will you be her kinsman redeemer? And he says, he has to reveal this, verse 12, now it is true, I am a close relative. It's true, I'm a Goel. However, there is a relative closer than I. You think when he first thought about that, probably months ago, he realizes that he may not be the kinsman redeemer because someone's closer, and he's kicking himself? I was born too late. I don't know. But forced by his integrity, Boaz says that he is a kinsman redeemer, but he's not the closest kinsman redeemer. And it would be not right for him to accept this proposal when someone else, by God's word, would be closer and needs to be considered. Boaz explains to Ruth that there's another man more closely related to her than he is. But he reassures her in verse 13, remain this night. When morning comes, if he will redeem you, good. He has the best interest of her at heart. Let him redeem you. But if he does not wish to redeem you, goes back to his promise, then I will redeem you. As the Lord lives, lie down until morning. If that relative won't marry Ruth, Boaz wins. It's been said that before Boaz married Ruth, he was ruthless. I've been waiting on that all month. Someone said that to me and I thought, that's funny. But consider here. Like that? But consider here, was he really ruthless? Yeah, we use that term kind of funny, but look at the character that she has. Look at the character that he has. That he wants to do things with integrity. He does things according to God's word. You know, we ask, you know, well, where else can we find a virtuous or an excellent woman? I'm wondering, in this culture, where else is there a godly man who does the right things at the right time for the right reasons? Might we be raising up better in this generation more Ruths and more Boazes in our homes so that the next generation, everybody will know where the virtuous women and men are? Because there's a deficiency in our culture. You know, I mean, there's television and there's radio and there's these popular people that we see and everybody wants to be like that. And I'm like, you're kidding me. You know, I look in Hollywood and I go, well, where is the virtuous woman? Where is the excellent man? There is not any. I look in politics. Where is the virtuous women, the excellent men? There's a deficiency there. And let us not just look on the outside of the walls of the church. Let us look within, in the church. The people who say that God is their God and the Lord is their Lord and He's the King of all. And He has, you know, He sits on the throne of my heart. We say these things. We say all our hope is found in you. And then we wonder, where are the virtuous women and the excellent men in our churches? Might we see in this challenge, and even in the book of Ruth, that even in the most corrupt culture, it is possible to be holy and righteous and to apply the truth that God enables us to live by His grace, by His mercy. So he reassures her, if this man doesn't take you, I will redeem you. Verse 14, so she lay at his feet until the morning and rose before one could recognize another. Why is that? Because she wasn't there for the same reasons many other women were in the tents of other men. And he said, let it not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor. Boaz requests that Ruth stay there until dawn and secretly leave, lest her mission be misinterpreted by the witnesses. Verse 15, again he said, give me the cloak that is on you and hold it. So basically, something's wrapped on her, and he gets the other end of it, stretches it out. So she held it and measured 6 measures of barley, and he laid it on her. Then she went into the city. This humility that worked in the right way, both of them, humble, both of them working in the right way. The last portion here is humility that waits on the right time. Waits on the right timing. Everything's been established, everything's set up, but now you have to wait. I wonder, will Boaz be my kinsman redeemer, or will it be another man I haven't yet met? If Ruth and Boaz had been deprived of sleep that night, what do you think mother-in-law is going through that evening? Laying awake, wondering how it went. So in verse 16, she doesn't let you wonder very long. When she came to her mother-in-law, she said, how did it go, my daughter? I can just imagine the eagerness in her voice. How did it go? What's happening? And she told her that all that the man had done for her. She said, these 6 measures of barley he gave to me, for he said, do not go to your mother-in-law empty-handed. Boaz sent those 6 measures based on a relationship he has with Naomi. He knows her. An expression of appreciation, perhaps, of Naomi's initiation, of proposing this marriage plan. Perhaps it's just a thank you, and it's a sign of good faith. I'm caring for you, regardless if this works out or not on the kinsman redeemer. Naomi reassures Ruth that Boaz is a man of his word, and he will not rest until he has followed through concerning her request. Verse 18, then she said, wait, my daughter. That's all you can do. You've done all that you can do. You must wait until you know how the matter turns out. For the man will not rest until he has settled it today. Preacher Vance Havner said one time, he who waits on God loses no time. I think of the various people in the Old Testament that waited on the Lord. Jacob learned to wait. In Genesis 49:18, I have waited for your salvation, O Lord, Jacob cries out. Hannah cried out in 1 Samuel 1:2, Peninnah had children, but Hannah had none. So she prayed and cried to the Lord for children and had to wait on God's timing. David prayed in Psalm 39:7, and now, Lord, what do I wait for? My hope is in you. Isaiah cries out in Isaiah 8:17, and I will wait on the Lord, and I will hope in him. Micah in Micah 7:7, therefore I will look to the Lord, I will wait for the God of my salvation. In the same line, Ruth is now waiting. She's not necessarily waiting on Boaz, she's waiting on the Lord to give her the answer. Humility waits. Humility becomes and welcomes the right counsel. Proverbs 1:5, a wise man will hear and increase in learning, and a man of understanding will acquire counsel. Humility works in the right way. Whatever you do, Colossians tells us, whatever you do, do your work heartily as for the Lord rather than for men. Humility waits on the right time. Rest in the Lord and wait patiently for him. Psalm 37:7. To close, I'll give you a quote, I'll give you a verse. J.I. Packer says, patience means living out the belief that God orders everything for the spiritual good of his children. And considering the life of Ruth and what she's encountering now and even into chapter 4 and the remainder of her life, and considering the application for us, I want you to think about Ephesians chapter 4, verse 1 and 2. Therefore, I, the prisoner of the Lord, implore you to walk in a manner worthy of the calling with which you've been called. That's the first step. Walk in a manner worthy. What does this worthy walk look like? He lists a couple of words here. With all humility, gentleness, with patience, and showing tolerance for one another in love. We've seen Ruth living out this life of humility and a life of dependence on the Lord. Next week we'll see the conclusion of God's answer to her prayers and God's providence and sovereignty even in ours.